Ms. Vignier.
All right, just some background information, then, like last night, we have three parables that we'll consider. These are very different than the ones that we looked at yesterday. So I'll just give you some background information on Kafka. In some ways, I think these ones are even more interesting than the other things that we've been looking at this week. And I'll say something about why I think so. So Kafka lived from 1883 to 1924, and he lived in Prague, which at that time was in Austria-Hungary, but now is in the Czech Republic. He was trained as a lawyer, and he worked for an insurance company, and he called his job his Brotberuf, which in German literally means his bread job. It was not the job he wanted to have, but it was the one that paid for his Brot, his bread. And so he was always trying to find ways of writing on the side. And he was a very influential author to particularly existentialist thinkers like Camus and Sartre. He died at 41 from tuberculosis, so he had a very short writing career. There is a style of writing that is called Kafkaesque that's used to describe any kind of nightmarish, surreal kind of experience, and so it's used as an adjective to describe any kind of thing that has those kinds of qualities, in particular when it has to do with bureaucracy. So he worked for an insurance firm, and a lot of his writings reflect the emptiness of the bureaucratic system, that there is some kind of message that's being sent from some kind of faceless, unknown nobody. And so several themes that come up a lot in his authorship have to do with disorientation, alienation, helplessness, confusion, complexity, the illogical nature of bureaucratic life. And this is something, I think, that is something that he saw in his own job, but also something that he thought was a symptom of his time. So you may be familiar with his writings, particularly The Metamorphosis, where we have Gregor Samsa, who turns into a giant beetle. He wakes up in the morning and he has been transformed into a bug. And then his family relates to him and his boss relates to him. And it's a very bizarre, nightmarish story. He also wrote The Hunger Artist. This is his last piece that he wrote when he was suffering from tuberculosis. He actually died of starvation because it was painful for him to swallow. So this particular text reflects somebody who was traveling around in a circus as somebody who could starve themselves for an extended period of time. He describes the feeling of starvation. He also wrote The Trial and In the Penal Colony and The Castle in particular talks about bureaucracy. So the three parables that we have for today are Passersby, The Top, and On Parables. Passersby talks about ethics and epistemology. The Top speaks about philosophy and who is the correct kind of philosopher. And On Parables is the way that we're gonna end up this whole series, by talking about the connection between parable and symbol in real life, if there is some kind of connection. So these three, unlike the ones that we looked at last night, are unrelated to each other, but pick up on themes that we've talked about already. So let's look at the first one, Passersby. Would somebody be willing to read it out loud?
When you go walking by night up a street, and a man, this whole long way off, for the street mounts uphill and there's a full moon, comes running towards you, well, you don't catch hold of him, not even if he is a feeble and ragged creature, not even if someone chases yelling at his heels, but you let him run on. For it is night, and you can't help it if the street goes uphill before you in the moonlight, and besides, these two may have maybe started that chase to amuse themselves, or perhaps they are both chasing a third. Perhaps the first is an innocent man, and the second wants to murder him, and you would become an accessory. Perhaps they don't know anything about each other and are merely running separately home to bed. Perhaps they are night birds, perhaps the first man's arm. And anyhow, haven't you a right to be tired? Haven't you been drinking a lot of wine? You're thankful that the second man is now long out of sight.
Wow.
So we should start, as we did with the cave allegory, just describing the scene, because it's a little bit confusing here and disorienting on purpose. And so we want to know exactly what literally is taking place here. What is happening? We know it's night. We know the narrator can't see very well because it's dark and has perhaps been drinking and so is disoriented by darkness, by intoxication. But what takes place literally here?
Two people run by.
And so then he asks himself, what should I do? What is the right thing to do at this moment? And what are the possibilities? What should he do at this moment?
Something or nothing.
And what could be the scenarios? He goes through a series of scenarios that could just describe the reason for why these two are
could
running past.
Murderer.
So one could be a murderer, the one in the front could be a murderer, the person behind him could be pursuing him. He could have stolen something, he could have wronged that guy somehow.
Or they could have amused themselves.
Murderer running after the guy he wants to murder.
Exactly. Yeah. Or what was happening?
But they're amusing each other.
It's
a game of chase.
They're chasing each other just for fun. Maybe they don't know each other, they're both running home because they're late. This is a scene of complete confusion. Something is happening. There are people doing something. I should respond. I have no idea what to do.
It's fear of doing something or fear of not doing something.
And so the philosophical question is an epistemological one. What can we know? If we're going to act on something, we need to know what it is that we're going to do. We have to know the situation. We have to know what our ultimate purpose is, how to resolve the situation. But here we're in a complete state of disorientation. We have no idea. And so how does it end?
He does nothing.
He does nothing. And furthermore,
it's already gone
he's
by.
Relieved. There's no way he could catch them anyway.
They're long.
Sounds like New York City if he does nothing.
So what are we to make of this? If this is a parable, if a parable is an instructive message, here we have a scene, we have symbols. Right, of disorientation, of not knowing. Something is demanded of us, but yet we don't know what to do. And oh, we're relieved because now it's too late to act on whatever it was. What are we to make of this? What does this mean?
It sort of sounds like the narrator is kind of rationalizing why he didn't do it, but the way he's writing it says you, so it's kind of like, it's like he's giving advice or saying it's about somebody else, but really it's about himself. Sounds like.
Yes.
Besides that, he's drunk. He's been drinking a lot of wine. So his mind isn't clear.
So there would, even if he was able to put all the pieces together in some kind of logical order, it would be impossible because he was intoxicated.
Does he say he was drunk?
Yeah.
Well, yes.
And you've been drinking a lot of wine and you're tired.
He's tired.
He says.
Or is that a rationale?
But it doesn't.
No,
so.
Excuses
that we make for ourselves. Yeah. It's dark. I'm tired. I'm drunk. I couldn't do anything anyways.
Yeah. And they're out of sight already.
With this amount of information, why would you do anything?
So it's not that bad.
Good. So now we can pursue the question a little bit further. Perhaps Kafka is asking us what we ever know and how can we ever respond in a situation of unknowing. I'm sorry, I'm going to use you as an example again. Ari learned about bananas and how they're produced in monocultures and how a lot of varieties have been annihilated and how they've been put in monocultures so that there can be a profit made out of and what takes place that actually this monoculture then creates a situation where the flavor quality depreciates over time.
Mm-hmm. The diseases can easily spread from one to another because there aren't different varieties, and so the bugs know to attack and how to attack, like the bananas. But it happens with all kinds of other foods as well.
Red delicious apples is a prime example.
So then she comes home after learning this from, was it bio class or history class? I'm never going to eat a banana again. And so this idea of once you have knowledge about something, you can't do anything. It's too large. It's too complicated to be able to change it yourself. And so this immobilization kind of thing takes place. But you also want to be defiant against it, but you're also immobilized because now you've learned something. So the question is whether or not you ever know enough really to make a logical decision to act upon, because there's so many factors. And we also provide ourselves with so many excuses not to. So it's, on the one hand, the problem of not knowing the situation. It's happening so fast in front of us. They're running. Perhaps we could say stop to one of them, but maybe the one that we stop is the one that's armed, and it would cause some kind of harm to ourselves. But again, that's a whole process of rationalization of why we should get involved also.
I suppose you could just yell out, "Can I help?"
Yes.
No, I mean, if you have a concern for in this particular situation, the way to try to get information is to put yourself out as a possible helpful person.
Right. And in doing that, you attract perhaps danger to yourself, and you also create some kind of obligation for yourself that clearly the character wishes to avoid. So I think that what Kafka is talking about here is something about what we can know or not know, something about our own psychology when something is demanded of us, about how we try to escape the demand that's placed on us. But I think that Kafka wants us to ask the kind of question that you're providing an answer to. What do we do in this case?
This situation actually almost happened to me, almost identically. It could be definitely parallel. I was at Bellis Fair Mall, which is a pretty huge mall in Bellingham, on the 23rd of December, when, because I am a procrastinator. So here I am at like 9 o'clock at night. It's the tail end of the Christmas season. Everybody's tired, but there's still tons of people around. And all of a sudden, I hear an altercation breaking out in women's lingerie, which didn't happen to be where I was, but was in the next area over. And I look, and there are three people beating up a smallish woman. I mean, I'm not talking about a little bit. And then there was racial stuff going on, lots of foul language. And I watched a big man grab her by an arm, pull her to himself, and then kick her in the midsection. I mean, the mall is fairly busy at this point, right? I am the only person that responded. And I am not big or male. But I could not stand there, and I yelled stop. That's what I yelled stop, and then I approached them. And when I thought about it after the fact, I was also a single mother of young children. I was like, what was I thinking or not thinking, you know? Because at the end of the altercation, the guy continued to fight with her, and I said, this is not cool. What are you doing? You know, and finally they stopped when I approached, and then they fled. But they fled toward me, and this great big guy, and he looked like a linebacker, came, and he got so close to me, I literally wet myself a little bit because I thought, my whole body tensed so tightly that I thought I was going to be knifed. And I realized that there was no place to go. And I just, that whole adrenaline thing, and then I ended up staying at the mall till like midnight waiting for the cops to review the tapes. It turned out that there was some stupid thing where the guy had, the girl had said something bad about the guy's girlfriend earlier in the day, and you could see them on the tapes tracking her. Anyway, I had none of that information at
yes.
the time.
Yes.
I just could not think of a single reason why right. that guy should beat that much smaller woman so brutally, and with two other people.
And you had more information than what we have here. Somebody was in danger.
There was definitely violence, yeah. But you don't know. This could be three steps before the violence happens, right? You don't know that. But what struck me after the fact was that there wasn't a single other soul. Nobody else came
forward.
People
want to get involved.
All those other people were rationalizing, like...
They were much quicker at it than I was. I'm much more emotive. I respond before I think.
And then you think afterwards.
And then I think afterward, you're really not very bright, are you?
One of the things that doesn't happen here is thinking about what would have happened after the fact. He's just glad they're gone.
Yeah.
And there's not any, like Jack Kerouac and his the road not taken, you know, that kind of thinking. He didn't think back and go, well, what if I should have done this, or what if...
It's or a guilt paper. Feeling afterwards.
Yeah.
He wakes up in the morning and he finds in the news something had happened and he was in a position to do something about
it. Or
it
could have been a good thing, you know, it doesn't have to be a scary thing. I just feel like it's like, okay, out of sight, out of mind, not thinking anymore.
Was the famous, was it the Skinner psychology experiment when he had one human protect themselves by giving shocks to another human being?
Yes.
And watching it? Wasn't that based off of this Kafka story?
I'm not sure, but I've
okay.
heard of that story.
Yeah. Yeah, that's
what
the way
we're
I
willing
heard.
To do.
Right, it's like that, an example
yes.
of a human propensity for self-perseverance, really.
That we're more interested in preserving ourselves. So when we
mm-hmm.
apply logic, then all of a sudden the defensive mechanisms come in place. I was drinking. I didn't know the backstory. I didn't. And you said, I don't know what I was thinking because I had small
yeah.
children.
Truth was, it needed me. And what was this was not my business, right? That's one of the other things we say. It's not my responsibility or my business to get in the middle of something like that. But at the other hand.
So these moments show some kind of true self. That's present before the thinking takes place.
Mm-hmm.
Do you engage or do you not engage? It seems to me that there might be a test there of a true self. We often, in our family, we say the test of a true self is how you act in an airport when you're in a hurry.
Yeah.
It's the same kind of thing. you don't have the comfort of time to think about responding in an appropriate way. Right? Shoving.
Mm-hmm.
Or getting in the way or getting frustrated easily.
I read a little bit like... maybe I'm missing something, but this person is coming right towards, and he took it very personally, like this person was coming personally to him,
mm-hmm.
and then when he came close, he wasn't coming to him at all, he was going, you know, and so he took it personally, and I mean, I remember the first time we were in Chelan, my son and I were in the park, it was like 8 years ago, and way across the park, this guy was waving and waving at us, or it seemed like it, and I didn't know who this was. I didn't know anybody in Chelan, and I was sort of going back and forth between, is this person personally getting my attention, or is there somebody behind me? And then he comes running over to us, to my son and I, and he came really close, and all of a sudden he realized he was coming to us. And it was really kind of bizarre. He had an onion in his hand, so he gave us this onion, and it was like May Day or Earth Day or something like that. But anyway, I got a little bit of this out of that. Like,
but this is a totally Kafka situation.
Yeah.
Just completely confusing, disorienting. Am I supposed to do something here? Do you know me?
Yeah.
Who am I?
Yeah, so we
yes.
responded like we knew him, and thank you. And he came up to hold him about 2 months later.
You didn't know him.
Did he bring an onion?
No. He was a character.
And I think when I read this through like the epistemological lens,
yeah.
The comical part of me wonders if there was initially one person running, and then someone was standing, like the same exact scene took place slightly beforehand, and then all of a sudden the second person started chasing that person out of amusement or perhaps out of fear or concern, and the same exact thing has taken place now, like again raising the question
looking in a mirror
of
a mirror.
What do we know and how do we know it?
Yes.
Yeah.
And perhaps that first person saw that. Is that what you're describing? The first person saw the first person running, and
yeah.
so they took after them to help or something, and so then
or
the third person who could
or,
say,
yeah.
I'm going to engage in this, and then a series of people following
mm-hmm.
each other in confusion.
Mm-hmm.
Why is the first paragraph have just one person, and all of a sudden you got two people? There's only one person referenced in the first paragraph.
Not even if someone chases
them. And then... That confused me because then afterwards he's talking about two people. Well, and how he started out, dude.
Well, the alcohol.
Is there some meaning to that?
I don't know.
Yeah,
I'll
just
and if somebody chases yelling at his heels,
yeah.
yelling, the person is yelling. And even that is hard to know. Is it yelling for fun, or they're scared or asking for help? It's all discombobulating.
Where do you get the yelling at?
The end of the first part. Well, you don't catch hold of him, not even if he's feeble and ragged creature, not even if someone chases yelling at his heels, but you let him run on. And this
but
idea
that's
of it,
a, that's not a statement of what is happening, that's a maybe.
Maybe.
Yes.
Maybe,
well, someone is yelling.
All of them, isn't the whole thing
maybe?
Maybe. I mean,
maybe.
Well,
maybe
he's an innocent man, and the second man, and maybe they don't know anything about
or,
each other. And
or perhaps they're both chasing a third.
Yeah.
Perhaps the
yeah.
Or
yeah.
Perhaps the first man is unarmed. I mean, the whole thing is a maybe. You, there's
you're
more that you don't know than what you do know. Yeah.
Yeah. I think the using the second person in the very opening of it instantly, like, that causes me to instantly read it as critical commentary on a culture. Like, otherwise, why would you use the second person, right?
Yes.
Maybe it's to distance yourself from the situation, though, and say, I didn't, you know.
That was their business?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
That was their game right there.
Yeah.
And I think, philosophically speaking, you know, if we want to go broad and symbolic with it, the epistemological point, we could say, this is all the time. Do we ever know enough to be able to make some kind of reasoned choice about what it is that we're supposed to do? We're always coming in midstream without enough information.
Can you define epistemological, because that's a new word to me.
Epistemological, so epistemology is one of the branches of philosophy. It has to do with theories of knowledge. What can we know, and how do we know it? So the traditional definition of knowledge, philosophically speaking, is justified true belief. So you have a belief about something, it has to be true. In other words, it matches up with reality.
Based
you
on
have
evidence?
To figure out a way of, yes, and then you have to figure out a way of justifying it through evidence or through logical reasoning.
Okay.
Or some kind of authority that you trust as being reasonable, providing that evidence. So epistemology has to do with what it is that we can know. And some philosophers take a completely skeptical position. We can't know anything.
There are no absolutes.
The only way you could know anything in this situation was if you knew these men and knew anything about their history, or if you asked, can I help? And try to communicate with them.
Or after the fact, the next day you read it in the paper.
And or afterwards, ask them, did you see him the next day, why were you running?
But you don't need
you
to know everything
immediately start off.
To act.
Yeah.
That's what I'm thinking, exactly. You got to take a chance sometimes.
Well, yeah, I mean, like Penny's situation, there you knew enough that somebody is getting hurt.
Yeah.
And that's all you need
and
to
that,
know.
And that, and while you also know that this guy's big and a bruiser, and there is some risk, but you still decide, do I take the risk or not?
But intriguingly here, we don't know if there is harm present.
Right.
And what if the two are simply playing, and then by chasing them, you cause the fear, or you cause the harm. Yeah.
Maybe the first guy dropped his wallet and the second guy's trying to give it back. I mean, you have no
yeah.
idea,
right?
Right.
One of the things that struck me when I first read this was there are so many different scenarios that could be taking place that as we spend time processing it, there's no way you could catch them. So he's relieved at the end that they're gone. But as you're working it all out, you're just kind of dumbfounded and stuck in this confused place because it could have been something good, it could have been something bad, but by the time you process all that, it's already done and there's nothing you can do.
The moment to act has passed, so it's at the moot point.
It's passed because you've been thinking.
Okay, this also, if this happens when they enact a new law, and you maybe would have a chance to have some input. But you don't understand what the implications are.
Mm-hmm.
And our politicians are voting for laws all the time that they don't understand the implications.
Yes.
And in California, where people come up with propositions, and then after they're passed, we get all kinds of implications that nobody understands or foresaw.
And the law is a perfect example. Action needs to be made now. You have to do something now, even if you don't have all of the information.
Voting is like that.
Yes.
How do you vote for a politician? You can only know what you can. I mean, holy crap! If you try to make heads or tails of the TV ads, you're definitely not going to vote based upon any information that you can do anything with.
Yeah.
I think if this is a parable, he wants us to think of it, or I'm thinking maybe he wants us to think of it broader. Do you ever know enough about anything to make a correct decision?
Or maybe the parable is you have to make decisions without having all the information.
Yes.
I mean, that's the way I would look at it.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. But there are some times when you, there well,
through your best
all
best.
The time, you cannot ever really know everything, but that can't freeze you up so that you never act, because you have to act
and you
and
always
get involved.
Have good excuses not to.
Yes.
And even
there
that can
plenty.
Be. So the knowledge that you don't have enough, but also that you can always find an excuse come at you from both sides to stop you from doing anything. So what is the right response? Is it to shout out, can I help?
If you have a need to act, yes. And I don't know that you have a need to act. Like I say, with this amount of information, why not?
I think the operative phrase there, the really solid information is that he is feeble and ragged. That's one thing we know for sure. I mean, it's somewhat subjective, but feeble.
It says
it
doesn't
not
say that.
Even if
he
is.
I think,
doesn't
I think
even
it's
say
saying that
he
is, though.
True.
That's his way of saying
that he is.
Even if you know, even if he
I
is, even
so.
If there's someone
okay.
chasing him, even if it's night, you know.
That's
why yeah. So I think if I were Penny, I would be inclined to intervene at that point because he is feeble and ragged and clearly needs. I mean, even if somebody wasn't chasing
yeah,
him,
basically,
he's
I saw bully is what I thought. I saw bully.
Yeah, but I mean, I was being a little facetious there, but I think that if you saw a feeble, ragged person coming
except
toward
that maybe
you,
he's. I mean, you could take the. This is. You could take the feeble and ragged, and he's just stole from a shop owner, and that shop owner is chasing him, and that's why he's.
But I don't know that.
No.
All
right.
I know is that he's feeble and ragged.
But to the point of not doing anything, if you read the next day in the paper that somebody got killed because you didn't do anything, then you go,
and that happens a lot.
Thought more about it.
Well, on the other hand, if you're the one that's in the paper because they killed you.
Yeah.
Well, then you're in heaven and
yeah.
you're in a better place. So it's all right.
Yeah, but your kids are pretty upset.
End up being sacrificed.
I think it's each individual's
one thing to be important, nothing not to choose.
Life experiences that let them act or react, you know. And that it's also their motivation to do or not do.
That's the word I was thinking of too, that we all have our own motivation. Some people are motivated more by their emotions.
I'd ever justify.
I don't know. But everybody has an individual way of responding. It's cultural. It's your individual experience, mm-hmm. like you said.
But still, the question remains: is there a best way that one should respond to this situation?
Yeah.
It depends on your context, too.
Right, but you could still argue that there is a best way that one should respond to the situation and. Maybe that's what we should be striving for.
What is the best way?
If you're a quick thinker. I mean, they're running. And you've got to assimilate everything and then flag.
Except that he says he saw him from a long way off.
Mm-hmm. Oh,
so there actually is some time, right?
Yeah.
First you just see the one person as they get closer and closer, and then you realize there's two. So there's some time to think about this. I would say.
One of the other things I think about in ethics all the time is when I'm sitting and reflecting on a passage like this, I think I do one thing. But when the moment comes, I will do something else, and it's usually to protect myself.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I was going to say, like, that Skinner experiment pointed out the very fact, like, if you were to see something in the newspaper next to that someone had died, is your true genuine response, I should have helped, or thank goodness I didn't go after them? And I think that's the question that Kafka's getting at. Like, deep down inside, what is your most primary instinct?
I can tell you that if you see me walking up to a door and you're on the other side and there's a little window and you put your face in that window just as I get to the door, you're going to get my left fist right through the window.
Duly noted.
That happened. That happened. I didn't know who it was, but it turned out it was a good friend and so forth. But it just, bang! Window glass in his eyes and everything.
What?
Why?
Well,
so, startled him, right?
Yeah, sure did.
It's you were scared. The face appeared all of a sudden, and so it was just an instinctual response.
Just blam! I had no time to think. So if I would have had time to think, I would not have hit whoever it was.
Why did you feel threatened if he was on the other side of the door?
Is it your door?
Is that what I understood?
Yep. I was turning the light switch off. And it was in the church. Up down the hall, or turned it on, actually. He saw what I was doing, and he came up to the window to, you know, start it. Well, he sure did. Well,
the guy was playing funny. Mm-hmm. Oh.
I now learned something new. Natural response is not violence. I would avoid violence if I could. So
you never know.
Well, that's where the context, I think, is really important too. You are alone in the dark, and if you were in a really unfamiliar environment, let's say you're walking through a street in a country you weren't familiar with, you might behave differently than if you're walking down your own street. If you're in a different culture, I was just saying, if you're in Japan, you might act differently than if you're in his hometown, or if you're on the street here today.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think it's not necessarily cultural, but contextual.
It's also different, like if you're by yourself, like you said, or if your kids are nearby, or there's other things that could totally play onto that too. Like, I never pick up a hitchhiker if I've got kids in the car. I do occasionally pick them up when I'm just driving, especially when I'm leaving from here to there and I'm tired. I'll pick up a hitchhiker just because they look like they need a ride and I'm tired, and it seems like at the time it seems like the right thing to do. But I don't pick them up regardless when the kids are in the car, contextually.
10 minutes left, so you guys get to pick which one we'll do. The second one is the top, which is talking about a philosopher who comes and interrupts a game that children are playing with the top. And then the last one is about parables, about the connection to practical life or lived life. So let's take a vote.
What do you think?
I use the top in my class at the end of the semester to talk about philosophy. But the one on parables might be more interesting given the context of the series that we've been doing this week. So it's totally up to you. So should we vote?
Let's flip a coin.
I like both of them. What's that?
Let's flip a coin. Then we don't have to worry about our knowledge of it.
Okay.
Yeah, we don't have enough
coin
information.
Yes, we have a coin. That's the problem.
It's my last dime, actually.
Literally.
Okay, heads is
the top.
Okay, you're going to be the authority here.
Yeah, make sure you're on it.
It's heads.
That's a real
answer.
That's a flip.
We didn't have enough information.
That's right. Would somebody read this one?
Yeah.
A certain philosopher used to hang about wherever children were at play. And whenever he saw a boy with a top, he would lie in wait. As soon as the top began to spin, the philosopher went in pursuit and tried to catch it. He was not perturbed when the children noisily protested and tried to keep him away from their toy. So long as he could catch the top while it was still spinning, he was happy, but only for a moment. Then he threw it to the ground and walked away. For he believed that the understanding of any detail, that of a spinning top, for instance, was sufficient for the understanding of all things. For this reason, he did not busy himself with great problems. It seemed to him uneconomical. Once the smallest detail was understood, then everything was understood, which was only why he busied himself only with the spinning top. And whenever preparations were being made for the spinning of the top, he hoped that this time it would succeed. As soon as the top began to spin and he was running breathlessly after it, the hope would turn to certainty. But when he held the silly piece of wood in his hand, he felt nauseated. The screaming of the children, which hitherto he had not heard and which now suddenly pierced his ears, chased him away, and he tottered like a top under a clumsy whip.
That's a wild story.
Okay. So I'll give you a few questions to think about while I give you some more information about this. And so the questions to think about are, what does the top represent? Who is the true philosopher in this? Because there are multiple people. And what is Kafka ultimately saying about philosophy? Now, on the surface, it seems as if he is providing a serious critique against philosophy. Because the philosopher is going into some kind of childish activity, messing it up, and he's doing it because he thinks that once he figures that out, he'll figure out everything. So here we have a picture of a philosopher who thinks that his goal is to kind of find the key to everything. What is truth? What is reality? What is ultimate meaning? What is purpose? All of these sorts of questions that if he can figure out a small piece, that will be some kind of linchpin or some key to this whole grand project that he's engaged in. The philosopher in this parable is portrayed as a fool. Historically, philosophers have been portrayed as fools because they stand in such sharp contrast to what is normally seen as regular society or practical society. People who earn a living, who do jobs, who do things that have real important consequences in life. Whereas the philosopher, the first philosopher in Greek tradition is Thales, the one who's walking along thinking about the grand principle of everything and falls into a well because he's so absent-minded. He actually falls into a well, and then people point and make fun of him and humiliate him. But he doesn't care because he's doing something else. And so we have these portraits of philosophers as fools, and so this is also part of the tradition of the philosopher as a fool. Goes into something that he has no business participating in, thinks that it's going to provide some key to his question. Of course it doesn't, and then he kind of totters away. And as he goes away, the children mock him and are upset that he's ruined the game. So the question here that we have to think about really primarily is, what is the top? What does the top represent? Why does the philosopher think that this is something, that this detail is going to provide some kind of key to his grand question? So we have to think about, what is the top, and why a top to represent that thing? What is it that's particular about tops as opposed to any other kind of toy like a puzzle or even a game of marbles or something? What is it about the top? There's a property of the top here that I think is really central to understanding what the symbol is using.
Motion. Is it has to spinning earth?
So it could be a spinning earth. It has to be something that's constantly in motion, that's moving. So it could be the earth. In my class, students throw out all kinds of things. Life, our meaning, our development.
Knowledge.
Balance. Knowledge. What's that?
Balance.
So any kind of thing that's constantly in flux and changing. Now, what happens when the philosopher intervenes in the game? What does he do?
Disrupts.
He disrupts it by doing what?
Stops.
He stops it. So it stopped being the thing that it was. So it's like, you think of like a greased pig. You're in pursuit of it, and as soon as you think you have it, it eludes you. The same thing with the moving top. Its essence is in the motion. So if you try to grab it, you've all of a sudden disrupted its essence, its motion. If it's not moving anymore, it's just a piece of wood. It isn't the top spinning anymore. So we can think about all the different symbols that the top can represent. The philosopher, if he's trying to understand life, and life is something that can only be itself as something in motion rather than something that is taken separate, objectively examined, dissected into pieces, descriptively described as something that we can see in some kind of objective sense, and all of a sudden ceases to be the thing itself. So on the surface level, we can read this as a sharp critique of a philosopher who thinks that he's going to figure out life, has no idea what it is because it's in motion. But I think the most interesting reading of this parable is to ask the question, who are, and this the question even gives it away, who is the true philosopher in this parable? So we have multiple characters that have a different relationship to the top.
The children.
So I think that Kafka is saying something here about children as philosophers. What are they doing with the top?
Playing.
Enjoying it. He doesn't enjoy it when he accomplishes what he sets out to do.
Exactly. So he's in this empty pursuit. He can't ever grasp the thing that he's trying to pursue. He would if he engaged in the game properly with the children, in some kind of playful, joyful exercise with it. That's the way the top has to be approached for it to be the top genuinely. So I usually use this parable at the end of my class because philosophy is a course that I was talking to Lisa yesterday, is a course that people can take in college and then at the end be like, I have no idea what that was just about. And then several years, like, I think I remember a paper I wrote for that, but not really sure. And I know that a lot of my students are going home to an uncle who'll be curious about the class and will ask them, what is philosophy? And they'll stand there just totally dumbfounded. I have no idea. So we use this parable at the end to do some kind of analysis about what is it that we were talking about. And this week we've been talking about all kinds of things, about knowledge, about free will, about what is the nature of reality, about education, philosophy of religion, and all of these kinds of things, and so we tie it together. What is it? It's these things that are in motion, these kinds of things that can't be examined in some kind of strictly objective sense, that has to be something that we play with and that we do in dialogue and discussion that's constantly changing and changes us, that it's the motion part of it that is central to what it is. Any comments about this parable?
Isn't a parable a one way of exposing the truth?
Yes, so a parable, the way that these philosophers have used it is to provide some kind of instruction.
Hopefully that's truthful instruction.
And so we want to know what is it that is the instruction. And I think in this case, it's to ask us to return to some kind of childlike playfulness with these questions, rather than to engage in some kind of strictly objective or scientific approach of analysis. Not to say that that doesn't have a place, because I think it does have a place, but if we say that that's the only way to approach these questions, then I think that we're going to have a problem when we're talking about things like life or meaning, things that are in motion. One of the things that we haven't talked about this week, so we've been talking about allegories and parables, we haven't been talking about the parables in the Bible. Here are examples of instructive symbol as well.
So that's tomorrow's subject. Checking in.
I think the danger of trying to analyze some of the parables is demeaning the true meaning of it by dissecting it and giving it definition. When
yes.
You don't, when it's a fluid thing, maybe you, like the top, has no meaning when it's holding still. And you're trying to take a slice like out of the history of the timeline and say, this is what history is and this is the understanding of the whole thing just from this 1 second in history. It just seems like putting a definition on something doesn't mean you understand it.
No, that's good.
I think that's true, because I think that we seek the formula or the definition because there's comfort in it, because it's something that's solid and static. Just like the philosopher, if he could hold it in his hand and examine it, he would have the key to everything. And there's something that's comforting about that, that we want to pursue that. But that project itself
that's
is doomed.
That limits it so badly by putting a human definition on something that's way more complicated, multidimensional. So,
yes.
Parables and scriptures have a major point. And we get into the trouble then when we turn it into an allegory, so that the parts become as important as the point of the parable.
So in the parables, do you think that there is one meaning?
Yes. Kind of an experienced meaning. In other words, you get a feeling of something as you take the whole parable in. So you're kind of focused on something, and that's what comes alive for you.
I've gotten different meanings from parables at different times in my life.
Well, that's
perhaps I'm wrong, but that.
That's why there's two bowls there.
That's why what?
There's two bowls there.
Parable.
Oh.
Yikes.